discussion in the Undersecretaries Committee at the National Security Council in the White House. According to Seaborg, though, the thinking of the undersecretaries was that they should maybe execute a couple more nuclear test shots before giving any final go-ahead to start using nuclear bombs to cut a new hole clear across Central America. They were all watching Project Rulison, of course, to see how that turned out in Colorado. And so was President Richard Nixon, who explained his feelings to the AEC chief, Seaborg, just 8 days into his first term in January 1969. President Nixon said he has a special prejudice for this program, the way all people have special quirks and prejudices, Seaborg later wrote. He thought this was something that should be accelerated. Project Rulison did have its naysayers out in Colorado, as you might expect. One expert from the Colorado School of Mines told an audience at a public meeting that to affect the release of 317 trillion cubic feet of natural gas from the shale beds in the Rockies, that would require not just one big blast, but more like 13,000 detonations of 50 kiloton nuclear bombs. Nobody could really be certain how much radioactive effluent would be floating in the natural gas or left at the site once the gas was extracted, either. People in Garfield County, Colorado, were becoming familiar with radioisotopes like Krypton-85 and tritium. They weren't much calmed by an AEC spokesman who tried to explain away the relative dangers of radioactivity by comparing it to iodine. Of course, you wouldn't drink it straight from the bottle, but one drop diluted in a glass of water is harmless. Even kills germs. A lawsuit filed by a concerned citizens group delayed the Rulison blast until early September 1969. Weather delayed it another week because AEC technicians worried that any radiation that might be vented into the air by the explosion could be carried into population centers by high winds. And then on top of everything else, when D-Day finally came on September 10, 1969, there were protesters in the mountains near the blast site. When the Atomic Energy Commission spokesman had announced that the agency's abiding interest in public health and safety would forestall detonation if anybody was in the quarantine zone, local hippies and environmentalists had taken that as an invitation. Chester McQuarrie wrote about it 25 years later for High Country News. "We scattered over the mountain in twos and threes," he wrote, "so that we could not all be removed in one fell swoop by authorities. At 30 minutes before blast time, we set off smoke flares to confirm for AEC officials that we were still on the mountain and inside the quarantine zone. A blue twin-rotor Air Force helicopter soon hovered 50 feet above the aspen clearing where Margaret Pools and I stood." McQuarrie says that although some of his fellow protesters were yanked off the mountain at gunpoint, that blue Air Force twin-rotor couldn't land easily on the steep slope where he and Pools had set up camp, and so the chopper let them be. He told one interviewer that an airman on board flashed him a peace sign as the helicopter flew off. The protesters had consulted a geologist who told them that when the detonation countdown started, they should get away from cliff faces that might fall or large trees or boulders that might bounce. They should prepare their own bodies for the blast as well. "We lay down positions so our feet, knees, and arms would absorb the shock and motion," which basically means they got into push-up position, or the dreaded plank. "Then a mighty whoomp," McQuarrie remembered, "and a long rumble moved through the earth, lifting us 8 inches or more in the air. We felt aftershocks as we lay there looking at each other, grateful that we were still breathing and all in one piece. Seismic detectors at the National Earthquake Center in Golden registered 5.5 on the Richter scale." The jarring seismic motion shook the liquid tanks at the nearby Union Carbide plant so badly that the chemical manufacturer had to shut down for 3 hours to unclog drains. A rock slide took out the Denver and Rio Grande Western Railroad's signal system, but it was quickly restored. Damage to local structures was what the Rulison project manager called of a minor nature and centered around cracked walls and ceiling plaster, cracked and broken chimney bricks, broken windows, lamps, and the like. The pre-shot estimates envisioned more than 400 damage claims, for which Austral had budgeted $200,000. But the big fears were not realized. The two nearby dams escaped uncracked. Interstate 70 had not been damaged by rock slides. Austral did end up paying a total of $110,000 on 322 separate claims, including $124.50 to a non-resident hunter who'd been miffed at being forced off the mountain on detonation day. The protesters who'd been taken off the mountain by force were released without charges. The AEC reported to Congress's Joint Committee on Atomic Energy that there had been no reports of injury to people or livestock. The bomb was exploded 8,426 feet beneath the Earth's surface, where it vaporized enough rock to open a 300-foot-high, 152-foot-wide cavern. The fracture zone radiated out 433 feet. The team had to wait a few months to allow the giant new cave to cool down and the detonation-produced radioactivity to decay a little. But it soon seemed apparent that our new friend, the atom, had performed an industrial miracle. That gas was stimulated. In 108 days of flow testing, according to the Project Rulison Manager's report, the volume is the equivalent of approximately 10 years of production from a conventionally stimulated well in the Rulison field. The report noted very little flow restriction through the penetrated fractures, thus confirming that an effective path between the chimney and the re-entry wellbore had been established. Mission accomplished. Almost. Turned out there were two problems. First, and most fundamentally, this new method of drilling for gas by atom bomb left the gas itself enhanced by its nuclear experience. Mildly radioactive was how the scientists put it, contaminated with krypton 85 and tritium. But here's the second problem. It was hard to say just how much tritium was in the gas or at the blast site, because the machine the scientists had brought to measure krypton and tritium contamination, a machine referred to by the excellent acronym STALCAT, it didn't actually work. In the otherwise cheery 265-page project manager's report on Rulison, this was the part where a little palpable sadness crept in. Though certain drawbacks with STALCAT were readily seen, not the least of which was a poor sensitivity to tritium, it was clearly the best available system. Yeah, you go to the bomb site with the STALCAT you have, not the STALCAT you might want or wish to have at a later time. The project manager noted that some quite active tritium material fell near the base of the stack early in flaring, and that the bomb site also tended to get littered with tritium when it snowed. But nobody honestly knew how much tritium that little slice of Garfield County had just been saddled with, because the damn STALCAT couldn't sniff it out. Under recommendations, the project manager was blunt. The STALCAT should not be used for monitoring tritium. Now, from a public relations standpoint, the mystery of just how much radioactive contamination Project Rulison had burped up into Colorado was a problem that might have been overcome. Once they started to get reasonable measures of how much radioactivity was actually around, public officials could always just raise the level of radioactivity that was considered safe for humans. Problem solved. That's how it worked with the hot milk in Utah, after all. But for all its technological dynamism, the cost-benefit balance of the program was daunting. It was going to require more and bigger nuclear bombs to make bigger caverns and greatly expanded fields of fractured rock if nuclear stimulation was going to be commercially viable. And atomic bombs don't come cheap. The boys at the AEC retained their can-do attitude, buoyed by the country's accelerating energy demand and by President Nixon's quirks and prejudices. He wanted more natural gas in a hurry, including the nuclear-bombed kind. Nixon's 1971 report to Congress on energy issues included the promise of more nuclear stimulation experiments, which seek to produce natural gas from tight geologic formations. In 1973, the AEC tried again in Colorado, in Project Rio Blanco, where this time it was three 33-kiloton nuclear bombs detonated simultaneously at three separate depths within 851 feet of one another. Radioactivity increased. Commercial prospects did not. In all, these gas-happy experiments cost about $82 million. The accountants figured that at the assumed rate, even with costs coming down, even if they took that entire coveted 317 trillion cubic feet of natural gas, the best they could hope to recover was about 40% of the cash outlay. And so died our nation's experiment in nuclear fracking, way back in 1973, after four glorious years of trying really, really hard. Nuclear stimulation equipment was mothballed at just the moment when Americans were beginning to get good and jittery about the guarantee of an ample and never-ending supply of fuel sources. The dire prophecy of the geologist and futurist M. King Hubbert, who said that oil production would hit its apex around 1970 and then begin a long, despair-inducing decline, seemed to be coming true, at least domestically. The era of low-cost energy is almost dead, lamented the U.S. Secretary of Commerce at the end of 1972. Popeye is running out of cheap spinach. This realization was followed by OPEC's surprise 1973 embargo that nearly tripled the price of oil. Filling stations became places of actual rage. Gas shortages, gas lines, and gas rationing were real things. Teenagers were called into school assemblies to hear apocalyptic messages about the energy crisis from earnest missionaries from the Church of Peak Oil. And natural gas was not going to save us in the 1970s because there just wasn't enough of it around to buy. The frigid winter of 1977 brought a state of emergency in New York, with Governor Hugh Carey ordering schools shut down for a week, banks open for only 5 hours a day, and in New York City, the power companies shut off natural gas supplies to anybody with access to other fuels. Con Ed asked its customers to drop their thermostats to 65 degrees, while New Jersey's governor flat out ordered the drop to 65 in all public buildings. General Electric just told its workers in the area to stay home. Columbus, Ohio had it even worse. That city closed 145 of its 172 public schools for an entire month for want of natural gas to heat the classrooms. Local media stepped up for a School Without Schools program that drew nationwide attention. The three major commercial television stations and several radio stations have canceled regularly scheduled programming for as much as 6 hours a day to provide teachers with 15-minute sessions of airtime for class programs. These are buttressed by publication in the Columbus Dispatch, the city's morning daily paper, of at least two pages of school lessons and a schedule of the classes to be taught on television, as well as other school-related activities in the city. In 1978, the federal government set stratified price controls on natural gas. Gas from old wells got the cheapest price, gas from new wells, the highest. The idea was to try to goose producers into finding new gas fast. But even with that new incentive, it was still blood from a stone. America just wasn't capable of producing enough natural gas to meet our immediate energy needs. So we had to be deliberate and cautious about how to use the limited supply that we had. The decisions we made about that in the 1970s would have consequences for generations to come. As Wall Street Journal reporter Russell Gold noted in his excellent 2014 book titled The Boom, natural gas was in such short supply that Congress passed a law in 1978 that essentially outlawed the construction of new gas-fired power plants. By the time the law was repealed 9 years later, the U.S. had built 81 gigawatts worth of power plants that burned dirty, reliable chunks of fossilized carbon, about a quarter of all coal plants that were still in use more than 30 years later. Even though the country all but gave up on natural gas in the shivering late 1970s, there were a number of people who still dreamed of that bonanza deep under the ground, who couldn't unhear the Bureau of Mines' estimate of hundreds of trillions of cubic feet of shale gas just waiting down there. Even after the Atomic Energy Commission's blasts for gas thing didn't work out, enthusiastic experimentation in fracking continued, subsidized by money appropriated by Congress. Private actors and public-private partnerships went back to the drawing board to puzzle out how to free shale gas or tight gas in an economically viable way. They no longer had nuclear bombs at their disposal, but they tested chemical explosives, cryogenic nitrogen that was supposed to freeze the rock until it cracked, and foamed carbon dioxide. The experiments got weirder and more arcane as people flung basically whatever was on hand at their local deposits of natural gas locked up in shale rock. The additives they tried were exotic and occasionally ridiculous. Consider one emulsion laced with the popular British toast spread Marmite. Marmite is a gooey, dark brown concoction made of yeast and vegetable extract. It's either delicious on buttered toast or the worst thing you could ever do to a perfectly fine piece of buttered toast, depending on whether you absolutely love it or absolutely hate it, which are the only two options. As for natural gas production, according to the petroleum industry trade publication GeoXPro, the thinking was that maybe if you shot enough of the gustatorily polarizing yeasty goo underground in just the right conditions, it would fuel production of special bacteria, which in turn would excrete enough acid to break down the rock and release the natural gas. Worth a try. Marmite is today as delicious as ever, and it is still advertised as an elixir capable of improving heart health, brain health, sleep habits, and libido, but it turned out not to work any subterranean fracking magic. For all the far-flung experimentation, by the mid-1990s, the basic idea of fracking was pretty straightforward. Inject enough fluid into the rock at high enough pressure to open up some narrow escape pathways for the stuff you wanted to capture. What should be in the fluid? That was the gazillion-dollar question. Recipes for fracking fluid called for a lot of thickening agents and a good bit of sand and a handful of toxic chemicals like hydrochloric acid and lots of other stuff, too. The mid-1990s era fluid tended to be gel-based and viscous so that it could deliver the sand, which was supposed to stay behind to work as a propant, that is, to keep the new micro-fractured passages in the hard shale propped open. Problem was, even after the gelatinous fluid was liquefied under intense subterranean heat, it remained gummy enough that it often stayed behind with the sand and blocked the newly cracked open pathways so the gas couldn't get out. Everyone knew the basic goal and the basic problems with reaching it, but as late as 1997, nobody had found a way to improve on the basic formula. You could get gas out of the ground, but not enough to make it worth it. The majors, like Exxon and Mobil and Chevron, had given up serious efforts on fracking innovation because it looked like the money invested was never going to return enough natural gas to pay off. They were busy hunting new oil and gas overseas, like in Africa or Eastern Europe, where they could get it cheap and easy. So the field of fracking was left wide open to the independents in general, and one very determined independent in particular, George Phidias Mitchell. If George Mitchell's life proved anything, it was that a man could map his own future and make his own luck. He was born on the Gulf of Mexico in Galveston, Texas, in 1919, son of a Greek immigrant who had herded goats at the base of the rocky escarpment of Mount Artemisio. Savas Periskevopoulos changed his name to Mike Mitchell for ease of operation in the New World. He raised his four children in a two-story brick building near downtown Galveston. The top floor was the domestic realm. The bottom housed the family-run laundry and shoeshine parlor. George learned early how to work hard, and he learned early that knowledge was key to his future. He studied petroleum engineering and geology at Texas A&M and took to heart advice from his department's most renowned academic. If you want to go to work for a major oil company, fine, you can drive around in a pretty good Chevrolet. But if you want to drive around in a Cadillac, you'd better go out on your own. George P. Mitchell went out on his own. And one of his first big bets put him in that Cadillac, as Russell Gold tells the story in The Boom. Mitchell had done his homework, combing through reams of drilling logs in a blueprint library in downtown Houston. He developed a very educated hunch that there was a whole lot of natural gas not far beneath the surface of Wise County, northwest of Fort Worth. And he was right. His first gas well there hit. So did the next dozen. He cobbled together enough investors to lease 500 square miles worth of mineral rights. In the early 1950s, Mitchell and his partners produced enough natural gas that they were able to sign a contract to supply a nice percentage of the needs of the city of Chicago on an ongoing basis. He eventually bought up mineral rights on 300,000 acres outside Fort Worth and became the number one natural gas producer in Texas, which was the number one gas-producing state in the country. But for all that, Mitchell was pretty sure he was only playing at the edges of a much deeper reserve of natural gas. The gas he was sucking out of the ground was what had managed to find little escape routes and migrate up to low-pressure rock formations. The real motherlode, Mitchell was pretty certain, was in the Barnett Shale, a tight rock formation way down deep, 5,000 to 8,000 feet underground. By the late 1990s, when all the major oil companies and government scientists had about given up on fracking in tight shale formations, Mitchell's decades-long interest in finding a way to get at that trapped gas had matured into something else entirely. He has a mind that people often refer to as persistent, Mitchell's son Todd told Russell Gold. To me, it's different than persistence. It was a form of obsession. He has a theme, and he would stick with it and stick with it. Mitchell kept plugging away at fracking, against the better judgment of the rest of the industry, against his company's board of directors, and even against the company president he had hired. Because he was the majority owner of his own company, however, nobody could really stop him. And anyway, as Todd Mitchell would note, he had a tendency to ignore obstacles. By 1997, though, George Mitchell must have been wondering if his long run of luck was finally coming to an end. The price of oil and gas was at a low ebb. Mitchell's stocks were dropping down to near $10 a share from a recent high of $35. A second wave of layoffs had pared the company from 1,300 employees to 800. Natural gas production was falling, and Mitchell feared the company might soon lose its ability to fulfill its decades-old contractual obligations to Chicago. But in the summer of 1998, a Hail Mary pass by a company engineer on the ground saved George Mitchell's bacon. It started, as so many things do in the oil and gas industry, as an attempt to cut costs. The fracking gels Mitchell drillers were shooting into the Barnett Shale formation didn't come cheap, and company engineer Nick Steinsberger figured it might be worth trying a frack or two with a fluid made up mostly of water. Steinsberger's recipe for slick water called for the same basic chemical additives, a hint of a lubricant used for face creams and contact lenses, a touch of gel made from the guar bean, which was grown in India, and sand, and water, lots of water, way more water than they had been using before. His supervisors gave him the go-ahead to try it on a handful of wells, but not much encouragement beyond that. One of them, according to Russell Gold, told him that he would eat his diploma if the idea worked. It took a few tries with the slick water to get it right. Steinsberger learned it was necessary to add the sand slowly, most of it late in the injection process. And he learned that it took a heck of a lot of water, like, say, 1.2 million gallons of water, and a heck of a lot of pressure to crack open the microfissures in the steel-hard shale. But the results were promising. Even the most successful gel fracks hadn't shown much staying power. Gel fracked wells might produce a million cubic feet of gas in the first days, but then drop off pretty quickly. The culprit was that gummy gel that stayed behind, clogging the sand-propped passages in the shale. But the S.H. Griffin No. 4, fracked with slick water fluid, was still producing almost 1.5 million cubic feet of gas per day in September 1998. 90 days after the initial frack. When Steinsberger checked it 30 days later, there had been no appreciable decline. Slick water turned out to be a cheap trick, but a damn effective one. This was the aha moment for us, Steinsberger later said. It was our best well ever in the Barnett. George Mitchell was thrilled. The company started using the slick water method on all its shale wells, and it kept working. The potential for shale gas was so big, said a newly hired Mitchell geologist who'd been studying the Barnett Shale for years, it made your head spin. That geologist, Kent Bowker, had been working at the oil giant Chevron, which at that moment was basically giving up on shale gas. Bowker later explained, "The handwriting was on the wall. I probably would have gone to West Africa." Instead, he quit Chevron, stayed home in Houston, and went to work for George Mitchell, the one man who might appreciate the magnitude of what was possible in the shale fields. Bowker made the case to Mitchell and his management team that there was nearly 200 billion cubic feet of natural gas in each square mile of the Barnett Shale, four times what the most optimistic geologists at Mitchell had estimated. "This is huge," George Mitchell exclaimed. "This is the biggest secret in the history of the company." Mitchell and his management team agreed that the thing to do would be to buy the mineral rights on every square inch of land they could get at in the Barnett, but quietly, quietly, so as not to alert other companies about what they had in store. Other companies, though, were not picking up what Mitchell was putting down. Skepticism reigned. Why would Mitchell Energy be able to crack the code that Exxon and Chevron and the other majors couldn't? 18 months after Mitchell's breakthrough, Devon Energy, out of Oklahoma City, passed on a chance to acquire Mitchell and its huge stockpile of mineral rights in the Barnett Shale. Devin's technical team had sized up the Mitchell operation, and at the beginning of the year 2000, it reported back to the bosses that slickwater fracking wasn't any great shakes. "We turned up our noses because we didn't think it would work," said Devin's CEO, Larry Nichols. But it was hard to ignore Mitchell's swelling production numbers over the next few years. Devin soon suspected that it had been wrong about Mitchell Energy and what it had to offer. In 2002, Nichols and his team at Devin plunked down $3.5 billion to acquire Mitchell. And Devin's resources and technical know-how turned out to be extraordinary value added. Devin engineers went to work and proved they could extract gas more efficiently and more effectively by combining Mitchell's new technology with the relatively new and little-used technology of horizontal drilling. Horizontal drilling allowed well operators to drill straight down and then make a right-angle turn at a chosen depth and then tunnel out thousands of yards more. Drillers could frack all along the horizontal line, which increased the potential pay zone exponentially. But it also required more slick water, a lot more slick water. Devin often injected 5 times the amount of fracking fluid Steinsberger had used on his first successful well. The horizontal gambit worked, better than the company had hoped. By June 2002, the Devin Energy suits were satisfied that they would probably be drilling new wells in the Barnett Shale for the next 15 years. They expected to sextuple the number of wells in the area to more than 6,000. Trillions of cubic feet of newly gettable gas suddenly seemed not so fanciful a prediction. The combination of slick-watered hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling was the breakthrough the oil and gas industry had been chasing for years. And it wasn't merely an upheaval of potentially epic commercial proportions. It was a hinge on which modern history has turned. A new genie was out of the bottle. It's hard to say, even today, if that genie is a friend. But he has had effect. Hydraulic fracking and horizontal drilling have rewritten the whole global energy equation and the future of a whole bunch of countries with it. It is one of the most extraordinarily important, disruptive, technologically driven changes in the history of energy, said the global head of commodity research at Citigroup about the fracking boom. It was revolutionary for the U.S. economy, and it was revolutionary geopolitically. Chapter 3. Stolen Goods. If there was anybody in Russia poised and positioned to take advantage of the new innovations in oil and gas production in the first few years of the 21st century, it was Mikhail Khodorkovsky. Khodorkovsky had grown a moribund little conglomeration of Soviet-era oil producers into the most successful single oil company in the Russian Federation. That company, Yukos, had grown under his leadership into a corporation worth more than $30 billion. It had doubled its output in just 4 years. By 2002, Yukos accounted for nearly 20% of the crude oil produced in Russia. Khodorkovsky was at that moment the most celebrated Russian businessman in the West. His company was widely regarded as the most technologically advanced corporation in his home country. It was stamped with the imprimatur of Western financial gurus. U.S. ratings agencies deemed Yukos the most creditworthy non-state corporation in all of Russia. The story of Mikhail Khodorkovsky and Yukos also happens to be a spot-on barometer for the commercial and political atmosphere of Russia in the decades surrounding the collapse of the Soviet Union. Khodorkovsky was born in 1963. He was a bright and unflappable youngster with a preternatural facility for understanding the game of life as it presented itself and for playing to the shortest odds. He saw early that the best career berths in the Soviet Union were solid government jobs where an ambitious and careful operator could move up through the ranks, acquire a series of bigger and more ornate apartments and nicer automobiles and luxury goods, maybe scoop up an increasing cut of the loot shaken loose by the officially sanctioned graft machine of the Soviet government. The ticket to that happy life was the unbroken demonstration of fealty to the Communist Party. So this son of apolitical and undistinguished working-class engineers dedicated his boyhood and his young adulthood to proving himself an enthusiastic and standout member of the Communist Youth League. And he succeeded, winning an entry-level job tending his minuscule part of the lurching Soviet machinery. Alas, just as his career in government was really getting underway in 1989, the Soviet Union began its slow-motion implosion. Khodorkovsky saw it happening, and he changed course on a dime. The boundaries of capitalism and democracy in Russia were still being chalked, the rules of the game still being written. But Khodorkovsky flew onto the field with abandon. "It's time to stop living according to Lenin," Khodorkovsky wrote in an essay right around his 30th birthday, as quoted by the author Masha Gessen. "Our guiding light is profit, acquired in a strictly legal way. Our Lord is His Majesty money, for it is only He who can lead us to wealth as the norm in life." Khodorkovsky didn't just sermonize about the pursuit of wealth. He practiced the life he preached, though in actual practice it wasn't always strictly legal, and it wasn't always successful. He started a small cafe. It failed. He started a business importing personal computers. It foundered. He started a bank. That worked. He made his first millions trading international currencies and managing funds for the Russian government, and kept piling them up, drafting in the exhilarating new wake of the first democratically elected president of Russia, Boris Yeltsin. Boris Yeltsin had done what Mikhail Gorbachev had been unwilling to even suggest. Yeltsin tore up the old USSR at its foundation. Yeltsin presided over the dissolution of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. He recognized the independence of those states, and he let loose the USSR's various satellites throughout Eastern Europe and Asia. Yeltsin exiled the Communist Party and seized its loot. He stripped national government apparatchiks of their control of business and industry. And for the first time in Russian history, he set free the torrential power of free market capitalism. In the first years of his presidency, Yeltsin sang the glories of populist capitalism, insisting that Russian businesses needed millions of owners, not a handful of millionaires. His boldness and his vision made him a heroic and popular figure among his fellow citizens deep into the 1990s, until his overnight decentralization of the economy began to get somebody forgot the training wheels wobbly. The Russian experiment once again proved that early-stage capitalism is a poor vehicle for spreading benefits far and wide. Almost all of those millions of would-be owners treaded in choppy, uncharted, and shark-filled waters, most without a stock certificate to their names. They were still trying to get the hang of credit cards and checking accounts, which were mainly empty. The impatient Yeltsin, meanwhile, steamrolled the national legislature when it tried to slow his dismantling of long-running state monopolies. As with most blunt tactics, Yeltsin's steamrolling had unfortunate and unintended effects. By the time his drive for privatization was complete, a handful of ambitious and canny sharks, the oligarchs as they came to be known, had won control of the major industries and various Yeltsin-sanctioned fire sales and rigged auctions. Dmitry Gololobov, who had been an attorney working for Russian banks and oil companies in the go-go Yeltsin years, wrote about that time, "The jewels of the former Soviet Union industry were sold in a corrupt fashion to a handful of well-connected men, forming the new Russian elite." This handful of well-connected men hadn't just made themselves millionaires. They had made themselves billionaires, and very quickly. President Yeltsin allowed this decidedly unpopulist national heist to run its course, with a wink and a nod from the Russian state. The Russian economy operated on a regime of insiderism, bribery, and coercion, in the words of the American reporter Peter Marse. And where political primacy makes fortunes and might makes right, much of the commercial life of the Russian Federation wound up as a criminal enterprise controlled in a kaleidoscope of partnerships among oligarchs variously connected to Russian politicians and a rising class of Russian mobsters. Boris Berezovsky, the top dog among Yeltsin-era oligarchs, would later confess, "I would submit all of my wealth to legal scrutiny, except for the first million." Yeltsin learned to look the other way, or to look the right way. When the Russian voters started to lose faith in their first ever democratically elected leader, his program of privatization was becoming known as grabification. Yeltsin was able to tap the now very deep pockets of the oligarchs to secure re-election. Mikhail Khodorkovsky was among that handful of new rich guys who poured money into Yeltsin's 1996 re-election campaign when Yeltsin really needed the help. And he was rewarded for it. Khodorkovsky became a skilled practitioner of grabification. He won his controlling stake in Yukos, an odd mashup of rusty Soviet-era oil-producing companies, at a rigged government auction that was, handily, run by his own bank. And just in time, too, because when the creakily built Russian economy collapsed in 1998, Khodorkovsky's bank was among the casualties. His last asset standing turned out to be Yukos, which he used all manner of tricks, perhaps not all strictly legal, to hold on to. It seemed worth the effort. Khodorkovsky, a self-styled man of ideas, had a big idea for his last best asset. Yukos could have toddled along for decades, like the government-controlled Lukoil and what was then the lesser stepchild, Rosneft, using inherited Soviet technology to slowly suck crude oil from fields in western Siberia and sell it on the world market. But Khodorkovsky had a little too much free time now that he'd lost almost all of his other businesses, and a little too much intellectual curiosity, and a little too much ambition. He decided to see if he could accomplish what no other Russian businessman had ever successfully done. Taking a Soviet-era hulk, as the Russian oil industry expert Thane Gustafson explained, and turning it into a modern corporation. Khodorkovsky began by rebuilding the corporate governance of Yukos. He made his company attractive to skeptical Western investors by committing to financial transparency and protections for minority shareholders. He established an independent board of directors, released financial statements worthy of the generally accepted accounting principles adopted by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. He invited outside auditors to review the books. Most important, he hired on experienced and respected executives and managers from French and American oil companies to ensure all these new corporate policies were properly implemented. Then he brought on an unlikely new head of production, an Oklahoma-born oil man who had worked in the United States and Europe and Africa. Joe Mock pronounced himself thrilled to make the move to Yukos, and he wasn't coy about why he was willing to pull up stakes again and go to work in godforsaken Siberia. "It's the same reason Bonnie and Clyde robbed banks," he explained to an American newspaper reporter in 2001 after his first year in Russia. "This is where the oil is. Not slim pickings like Oklahoma." Mock fairly salivated at the geologic wonder of his new stomping grounds. "Siberia is the simplest environment in the world," he would say. "The West Siberian landscape has not changed in 130 million years. You can go 1,000 kilometers. It's the same goddamned sand. All across, it's 18% porosity. The water saturation is very consistent. The other no-brainer is that the reservoir pressure is 4,500 pounds and the bubble point's 1,800. In other words, it's pure oil. Man, it doesn't get any simpler than that." Problem was, in Western Siberia, it had been too simple for too long. Mock found it difficult to get a quick buy-in for Yukos' new ambitions from the thousands of Yukos drillers and production pros who had grown up in the Soviet system, where managers were always guarding against the mistake of making too many tractors too fast. There was no urgency about the numbers when Mock arrived at Yukos. There was urgency about maintaining full employment, preferably until the end of time. The governing idea in the Yukos-owned oil fields was to drill new wells constantly and milk even the lowest-producing wells for as long as possible. The roughnecks in western Siberia might not eat well, but they would eat for a lifetime. Stoicism and resignation were the dominant traits in the Russian oil fields. "We never expected anything good," a Yukos employee had once explained to Khodorkovsky. "And if nothing good was coming, the priority would be to make sure that what little you had already never went away." Joe Mock went in determined to explode that system. Along the way, he introduced a gritty new form of Russo-American cultural exchange. He prowled the oil fields, demanding closure of the poorest producing wells and insisting on employing new methods for the best. The old Russian hands did not much appreciate Mock's suggested drilling innovations, but they did have grudging respect for his volcanic Oklahoma-style profanity, which he insisted be accurately translated for his Russian auditors. The Siberian roughnecks gave as good as they got. "When Joe first arrived, our guys said, 'We know everything better than everybody,'" Khodorkovsky explained to a Russian newspaper in 2002. "But Joe says, 'Set the pump lower.' And they say, 'Go fuck yourself. Da pashulti.' Because we knew that if you set the pump low in the well, it'd burn out. Joe insisted, so we lowered it, and it burned out. Another one, and it burned out too. 6 pumps burned out, but Joe kept saying, lower, lower, goddammit. 1 out of 3 will burn out, but the other 2 will work so well that you won't miss the 3rd one. Joe Mock eventually prevailed. He shut down the weakest half of Yukos's 14,000 wells and lowered the proverbial pump in the rest, bringing U.S.-style cutthroat aggression and ingenuity to the Siberian steppes. He used the new and improved hydraulic fracking on the best remaining wells. I jumped on that enhancement like a chicken on a June bug, Mock boasted to the New York Times. Translation still pending. Production at Yukos jumped more than 10% in Mock's first year on the job, and the company was soon producing a 1/5 of all the crude oil coming out of Russia. By then, however, Khodorkovsky's status as a favored man in the Kremlin was no more, because the presidency of Boris Yeltsin was no more. A career launched as a crusader against privilege and corruption devolved into, well, a life of privilege and corruption. Yeltsin proved in the end to be a very interested pig at the trough, amassing a tidy private fortune for himself, his wife, his daughters, and select friends. When he resigned on December 31st, 1999, sitting at his desk with a festive, tinsel-adorned Christmas tree behind him, he did so under threat of criminal prosecution while overseeing an economic implosion that dwarfed America's Great Depression of the 1930s. The Russian GDP had fallen by 40%. The government defaulted on its debt obligations. The ruble tanked. Russian banks verged on collapse. Inflation soared. Estimates were that an extra 3 million Russians a year were dying from hunger, neglect, and alcoholism. By the time Yeltsin went, only a handful of Russians were sorry to see him go. Yeltsin did manage to install his own replacement on his way out of office, a little-known Paul who appeared both willing and able to shield the Yeltsin family from criminal prosecution, 47-year-old Vladimir Putin, a trained Soviet KGB operative then heading its successor outfit, the FSB. Putin had done the sitting Russian president the memorable favor of successfully derailing the criminal investigation into the Yeltsin clan. He did so by blackmailing Russia's prosecutor general with a fake sex tape. Putin made sure the grainy tape of an actor playing the prosecutor general and 2 prostitutes playing themselves was broadcast on Russian television. The poor quality of the video rendered it slightly unconvincing, but Putin made an appearance at the TV studio that night to personally vouch for the tape's authenticity. His words sufficed. The prosecutor resigned, and the case against Yeltsin was abruptly closed. Yeltsin had rewarded the FSB boss's intrepidity by nominating him to be the next Russian prime minister. So when Yeltsin stepped aside on the final day of the 20th century, Vladimir Putin was the next man up for the Russian presidency. It was like spin the bottle, said Strobe Talbot, who was monitoring the situation for the U.S. State Department, and the bottle stopped spinning at Putin. Putin was a different kind of cat from Yeltsin. He had not had his head turned by Western Pauls or Western economists or the color-splashed vision of Western plenty that had wowed Yeltsin on his visit to a supermarket in Houston in 1989. Putin was disgusted by Yeltsin's swoon over the free market. He was shamed by the public spectacle of Yeltsin's drunken reel down a path of certain national disaster. Putin had been educated in KGB school and was stewed in the dark arts and dark ethic of that estimable and potent Soviet institution. The sworn agents of the Soviet security forces were all about Soviet security. Or, now that there was no more Soviet, all about Russian security. They were practiced and practical-minded operatives. They were going to wipe away the embarrassment of the Yeltsin debacle, stabilize the moribund domestic economy, and most important, reestablish Russia's sense of honor. As the late Russia specialist Karen Dawisha put it, Putin's objective, and the objective of those who came to power with him, was to restore the idea of Russia as a great power and a state worthy of and demanding respect in international affairs. Putin and his security-minded retinue had learned a few tricks for exercising power after branching off from spying into politics to run Russia's second city, St. Petersburg, in the early 1990s. Like the Yeltsin-made oligarchs, they found that democracy and capitalism harnessed just so could still deliver personal benefits, just like the old communist regime did. Putin's team installed and managed a vigorous kleptocracy from their offices at St. Petersburg City Hall. The citizens of that city might suffer from want of food and electricity and decent wages, but Deputy Mayor Putin and his key aides made out splendidly. Putin and his chosen minions, the Siloviki, controlled the economic and political life of the city and began to amass real personal wealth by working the seams between democratically elected officials, foreign investors, billionaire oligarchs, and organized crime bosses. Putin's St. Petersburg clan relied on graft, financial manipulation, and violence as needed. There was no government or civil institution powerful enough to check them. The courts and the legal system were not instruments of justice in Siloviki hands, but instruments of power, or vlast. For my friends, everything. For my enemies, the law, as the saying went. Putin and his Siloviki carried these tools from St. Petersburg to Moscow in 1996 at Yeltsin's invitation, and then ultimately into the office of the Russian presidency in the year 2000. Putin showed a comfortingly calm, competent face to the world when first elected president. He spoke of what was required in Russia to guarantee democracy and prosperity for all, and of national self-sufficiency. He promised to be a team player in world affairs. He had oil and gas to provide to the world market. The Russian people got a less soothing picture of exactly what Putin meant to accomplish in the days leading up to his inauguration, when a leading liberal newspaper in Moscow published the secret Siloviki Manifesto titled Reform of the Administration of the President of the Russian Federation. The document was tidy, easy to understand, and uncommonly forthright. Control over the economy and politics would once again devolve to a central authority, that is, the president's office. The legislature of the Russian Federation, the Duma, would be rendered impotent, as would local governors, administrators, and politicians, no matter how seemingly friendly. Key media outlets would be bought and controlled by the Russian government to help provide active agitation and propaganda in support of Putin, and to actively discredit and undermine any opposition to the same. Who would be in charge of the state's new modern adventure in securing permanent, unitary, unchallenged power? The institution Putin most trusted, the FSB. The manifesto said it outright. All of the special and secret activities of the directorate relating to counteracting the forces of opposition to the president will be entirely in the hands and under the control of the special services. The toughest nut for Putin to crack when he first took office was the question of the oligarchs Yeltsin had left behind and their powerful gangster counterparts. A few months into his new regime, President Putin called them all, including Khodorkovsky, to a meeting at Stalin's old dacha just outside Moscow, still outfitted with the desk and daybed from which Stalin dreamed up his great purge of enemies and elites. With that unsubtle setting as an ambient cue, Putin laid down the new law, or more precisely, the new balance of vlast. They could hold on to their ill-gotten gains, Putin told them, and operate as they had for the last decade, as long as they offered no opposition to the new regime in the Kremlin. If anybody in the room was unclear as to the purport of Putin's message that day, or the genuine feeling behind it, what soon happened to Mikhail Khodorkovsky ended all confusion. Khodorkovsky didn't know the limits, said the chairman of Yukos's largest rival, Lukoil. He didn't realize that when power went from Yeltsin to Putin, things had changed. Khodorkovsky's cardinal sin against the Russian state was being overly successful and overly independent. While production capacity at Yukos had doubled in just 4 years, production at Russia's state-controlled oil companies like Lukoil and Rosneft edged up by barely a percent or two a year. Profits at Yukos soared, as did its valuation, from $320 million to $21 billion, as did Khodorkovsky's personal fortune. One key discovery he made along the way is you don't get rich by selling oil, Thane Gustafson explained in a talk promoting his recent book, Wheel of Fortune. You get rich by selling stock. He was going around to London and New York and convincing people Yukos is worth buying and increasing the capital value of the company. By 2003, Khodorkovsky is the richest man in Russia. From the Western vantage point, Khodorkovsky's success was proof that free market capitalism was still the bomb, whatever Yeltsin's screw-ups. So powerful it could grow blue ribbon winners, even in the wan, depleted soil of the former Soviet Union. Khodorkovsky's company had become the premier oil company in Russia because of its superior management, its financial transparency, its commitment to technological innovation. Khodorkovsky and Yukos had won on the merits. In May 2003, the Wall Street Journal, that devoted town crier of the free market, ran a loving profile of Khodorkovsky pegged to his next venture. Late last month, the 39-year-old Mr. Khodorkovsky picked his new battle, one that promises to shake up the world's $550 billion annual oil market. Unveiling a $13 billion deal to acquire competitor Sibneft and create the world's sixth-largest publicly traded oil and gas producer, he pledged to turn Yukos into the first Russian heavyweight in the global energy arena. That story must have produced a series of spit takes among the Siloviki manning the presidential offices of the Russian Federation. Putin and his St. Petersburg clan were already wary of Khodorkovsky, and this profile proved him, inarguably, a threat to national security, or at least to Siloviki security. The journal reported that the crown prince of Yukos had been invited to Houston by President George W. Bush, personally, to help map out a plan for greater cooperation between the U.S. and the Russian oil industries, that Khodorkovsky had plans to challenge state-controlled Gazprom's monopoly on exported natural gas, that Khodorkovsky had plans to fund two anti-Putin political parties, and might even be considering a run for the Russian presidency himself. The journal also recounted for an international audience the story of a recent public meeting Putin had called with key Russian oil executives. The colloquy held at the Kremlin was widely publicized and televised across Russia. Khodorkovsky had used the platform to stand up and ostentatiously challenge Putin and to accuse Putin's pet oil company, Rosneft, of corruption. He had a PowerPoint presentation to back it up. To those who knew Putin, Masha Gessen would later write, it was clear from a characteristic smirk on his face that he was livid. All this might have been forgiven, given the extraordinary tax revenue Yukos was adding to the Russian government till, as much as 5% of the annual government take, according to Gessen. But Putin believed by then that Khodorkovsky was also in the middle of entering into a pact that was something near treason. It wasn't just the noise about promoting anti-Putin political parties. It was worse. Putin learned that Khodorkovsky was negotiating a deal with Lee Raymond and Raymond's number two, Rex Tillerson, that would give ExxonMobil 30% of Yukos, a deal that might one day permit the American company to gain controlling ownership of the most able and impressive company in the single crucial industry in Russia. Russia might not have been a superpower anymore. It might not have had a first-world military or economy or anything else anymore. But by God, Russia had oil. And now Russia was supposed to willingly give that up, too? The thought to Vladimir Putin must have been somewhere between nauseating and enraging. Khodorkovsky's great meritocratic free market ride came to a screeching halt. For my friends, everything. For my enemies, the law. Putin's henchmen arrested and jailed Khodorkovsky in October 2003. They drew up a host of tax evasion, fraud, and embezzlement charges against him. They ran sympathetic witnesses out of the country. And ultimately, they won multiple convictions. Vlast. Khodorkovsky was sentenced to 9 years in prison, while Russian prosecutors were already drawing up new charges. The new Putin-Siloviki axis, according to the former Yukos attorney turned London-based economics professor Dmitry Gololobov, functions in two main directions: the control of all the profitable business and direct confiscation from those who are not loyal. But Khodorkovsky's imprisonment and ruin were only an amuse-bouche. Putin meant to swallow all that Khodorkovsky had built, that big, beautiful, now $36 billion oil-producing enterprise, for Mother Russia. It was cute what Mikhail tried with selling pieces of Yukos to minority shareholders. Adorable with the Western-style financial transparency. Free market competition on fair terms was really a lovely idea, but not really Vladimir's type. Team Putin began with a series of audits of Yukos in the weeks after Khodorkovsky's arrest. By the time the Russian Federation's tax accounting department was done, Yukos had received bills for back taxes, including interest and penalties, totaling $27.5 billion. This would have been a difficult bill to settle in the best of circumstances. But because Putin's government had also frozen the corporation's liquid assets and crippled its production operations, Yukos found it impossible to pay. Putin's Russian Federal Property Fund provided a solution, though. The fund auctioned off Yukos's key subsidiary, Yugansk Neftigaz, which accounted for 60% of its annual oil production and an even greater percentage of its $36 billion valuation. The auction took place on December 19, 2004. It lasted in the neighborhood of 6 minutes. The winning bid was a highly discounted $9.3 billion. The only real surprise was the successful bidder, a corporation nobody in Moscow had ever heard of, the Baikal Finance Group. When journalists got a hold of the group's registration documents, they discovered Baikal Finance was just 2 weeks old and had been incorporated with an initial capitalization of $300. Its offices were above a vodka bar in a small building in the remote medieval town of Tver, 3 hours from Moscow. According to Masha Gessen, that same address was claimed as corporate headquarters by 150 other companies, none of which appeared to have any physical assets. The mystery of how a $300 company housed above a saloon bought Russia's most capable oil company for $9.3 billion didn't last long. A few days after the auction, the state-owned oil company Rosneft tapped government funds to relieve the $9,300,000,300 Baikal Finance Group of its single asset, Yugansk Neftigaz. Rosneft, with a lot of help from Putin and a few other surprising sources, would sweep in the rest of Yukos's discounted assets over the next few years. The acquisition of Yukos triples the size of Rosneft, Thane Gustafson explained, and what had been a very minor and no-account company suddenly becomes the largest oil company in Russia. It was flat-out state-sponsored theft of a legitimate company, the Kremlin just shoplifting a capitalist something that might have otherwise actually succeeded on its own merits, a shiv in the supposed meritocracy of capitalist competition. And it had a big Western helper. We can now appreciate just how important this help was, thanks to some serious reporting by a team of Bloomberg reporters. Here's what they turned up. Rosneft's greatest non-Putin abettor in its campaign to devour every last bone and feather of Yukos turned out to be the American investment banking titan Morgan Stanley. Morgan Stanley had been doing business out of its office in Moscow since 1994, when Boris Yeltsin was beginning to goose the pace of privatization. When other Western financial institutions fled Moscow as the Russian economy collapsed, Morgan Stanley held firm. It kept its Moscow office fully staffed and hired a Russian economist named Ryer Simonyan to run it. Simonyan's previous job was vice president of international investment for Rosneft. Among Morgan Stanley's crucial business operations in Moscow over the next 5 years was rescuing Rosneft from extinction. When Rosneft began to gorge itself on Yukos in 2004, Morgan Stanley's loyalty and friendship finally started to pay real dividends. With more than half of Yukos in Rosneft's gaping maw and the rest being crammed in as quickly as possible, Rosneft's boss, Igor Sechin, was ready to embark on some serious growth plans. He was tired of playing second fiddle to Lukoil. Sechin and Rosneft had Putin's blessing. He was head silovik among Putin's siloviki. He would make sure Rosneft's success accrued to Putin's advantage. But the Russian state banks were a little thin on rubles circa 2005, so Sechin needed a lot of new investment from the West, which meant he needed help from the likes of Morgan Stanley. Western investors were spooked by Putin's gangster move on Yukos, and for good reason. An international arbitration court at The Hague would eventually find that Putin's government had illegally confiscated tens of billions of dollars from Yukos and its shareholders. The international economist and former Russian Federation advisor Anders Osland opined, "It's always wrong to handle stolen goods, and Yukos was stolen goods." But Morgan Stanley exhibited few qualms. Rosneft was perceived as a world-class company that deserves respect, the investment bank CEO later explained, and it was always nice to be able to count on elite whataboutism from select Russian specialists at high-end American universities. The New York University history professor Yanni Kotsonis told the reporters from Bloomberg, "What was Morgan Stanley supposed to know at the time? We knew that Russia was corrupt, but that applies to virtually any country producing oil nowadays." Morgan Stanley ran Rosneft's traveling roadshow through boardrooms in London and New York, serving as a character witness for the Russian oil giant. Sure, Khodorkovsky was living in a cage, but that's because he was a crook. Look, you can tell he's a crook. He's in a cage. The tour was so successful that Sechin hired the troop's leader, a 36-year-old American, to be Rosneft's chief financial officer and to oversee what the company hoped would be a record-setting sale of public stock on the London Stock Exchange. Peter O'Brien is living proof that the Kremlin is not what it used to be, institutional investor wrote soon after his hiring, or at least that Vladimir Putin's lieutenants are trying to learn how to charm investors. Whatever O'Brien's own charms, and despite Morgan Stanley's energetic PR efforts, the initial public stock offering for Rosneft still faced headwinds from the West and from across the political spectrum. George Soros wrote an op-ed in the Financial Times about the dangers of investing in a company that would still be controlled by Putin's government. Rosneft is an instrument of state that will always serve the political objectives of Russia in preference to the interests of the shareholders. Soros asserted that a successful IPO would legitimize the Yukos theft, and because Europe was so dependent on Russian oil and gas, it would increase Putin's ability to wreak havoc there. When Vice President Dick Cheney started making essentially the same argument against the Rosneft IPO, it might have been the first time George Soros and Dick Cheney agreed on anything. But criticism from the unlikely Soros-Cheney alliance was about as effective as a painted-line speed bump, especially because, thanks to the smash and grab of most of Yukos, Rosneft would soon have oil reserves to match ExxonMobil. And the price of crude oil had doubled in less than 5 years and seemed headed toward $100 a barrel. The world's most prestigious investment bankers, lawyers, and accountants are lining up to embrace the Rosneft offering, wrote the decorated business columnist Alan Sloan at Newsweek. But remember that financial markets and financial professionals are frequently blinded by money, and there's enough money here to blind anyone. J.P. Morgan joined Morgan Stanley as one of the four joint global coordinators and bookrunners, while Goldman Sachs signed on as a senior co-lead manager. To put it bluntly, Rosneft's IPO campaign ended up making the world complicit in Putin's theft of Yukos, and it spread the shame of it around the globe. The markets knew the Russian government had ripped off that company and framed its leader, flat out stealing billions from Yukos shareholders. But Morgan Stanley and the markets and the investors in those markets chose to look the other way, just because the potential payoff was too enticing. Rosneft's IPO raised more than $10 billion in cash on the London market. When the news first hit, the IPO ranked as the sixth largest in world history. Analysts thought that when the final tallies were made, it might jump past the $10.6 billion take from 2000 for AT&T Wireless. Billions of dollars of investments are being made by major foreign partners, Putin crowed on hearing the results. I think this is absolutely correct. I am happy. Happy Putin could imagine the world lining up to pay respects at his doorstep, according to the New York Times, in spite of his gangster behavior and in spite of the fact that the Russian oil and gas industry he controlled was still known for its tumble-down machinery and technological deficiencies. President Vladimir V. Putin has elevated energy to a central position in Russia's foreign policy, the newspaper wrote in 2006, giving Moscow influence and respect in world affairs not seen since the demise of the Soviet Union, as consuming nations court the Kremlin for access to ever scarcer energy. Putin wanted more. More respect, more influence, more oil. And he got it with a little more help from his friends. In 2007, Morgan Stanley helped to arrange another round of financing that allowed Rosneft to hoover up the last of Yukos's remaining assets. A State Department cable that year recorded Peter O'Brien, the Russian's young American frontman, assuring a visiting U.S. Undersecretary of State that corporate governance at Rosneft and other major Russian companies, while not yet up to Western standards, has improved dramatically. What Morgan Stanley won for all its efforts, aside from an estimated $360 million in fees in a 10-year span, was the great goodwill of Vladimir Putin and Igor Sechin. The Russian president and his Siloviki were learning to live with foreign mega-businesses like Coca-Cola, General Electric, Toyota, and Daimler Chrysler doing business on Russia's sovereign soil. But the Kremlin's favorite American bank looked like a special case. Putin and Sechin privately hosted Morgan Stanley's CEO, John Mack, at the presidential estate outside Moscow. When the longtime head of Morgan Stanley's Moscow office, Ryer Simonyan, was presented with Russia's Order of Honor in recognition of his work on Rosneft's spectacular IPO, John Mack from Morgan Stanley was invited to attend the ceremony. Sechin also included Mack among the select for a dinner cruise down the Neva River that evening. Sechin treated Mack well and with respect, Simonyan later recalled, according to the Bloomberg reporters who uncovered the long, queasy history of Morgan Stanley in Russia. Mack clearly understood the coins of the realm, loyalty and friendship, and just how important they were. He knew, for instance, that it would be good for business to make the long trip to Sochi on the Russian coast of the Black Sea to make nice at the annual International Investment Forum. CEOs from other American corporate giants were there to meet with Putin in public that day in Sochi. The Russian leader was respectful to each of them, but not particularly warm. "We would welcome the expansion of your company's activity in Russia," Putin told the head of a Texas-based investment group with a starter office in Moscow, "and hope that you will find new opportunities for investing your capitals and the capitals under management." Putin told GE's Jeffrey Immelt, "We'll be happy if you expand your presence in the Russian market and cooperate with Russian partners, which will result in business development and technology exchange." But the way Putin addressed John Mack was demonstrably different. The Morgan Stanley CEO had limboed deeply enough under the constraints of legal and financial decency to help build Putin his own major international oil concern. And that afforded Mack the warmth and special recognition due a loyal and respected friend. Praising Mack's $55 billion